All right, as has been said already, we are starting our new series in Judges, but before we do, I just have to point out this here is the very definition of understanding the assignment. I told our decorating team they should be creative, they should be artistic, they should make this a place where we enjoy artistry, and they knocked it out of the park. So I just wanted to thank them. This is incredible. I told them Judges is going to be a book that is dark, that has some pretty sinister and not fun things in it, so let's make the stage reflect that, and man, did they nail it. And I also wanted to give a big thank you to actually York Public School. Their theater department actually let us borrow some of these props, the shields and the swords that you see here were actually borrowed from the theater department in York. So a big thank you to them. Parents, if we can be a little careful with them, with the kids, just making sure that those don't get broken so we can return them in the same quality that we borrowed them in. That would be awesome. All right, with the book of Judges, this is the last time I'm going to say it, and then we're going to launch into the book. Parents, I am inviting you to read along with us. We are going to basically be doing a chapter a week, and as we move through, you can tell from the title, Down to the Depths, this book is going to go down to the depths. It's going to get darker and more sinister the farther we travel into the book. So it would be a good idea for parents to be about 1 to 2 weeks ahead of me in case we need to do something with the kids, in case we need to put some protections in place because this book goes to some dark places. I am not planning on taking it any farther than the book does. In fact, I may even take it a step lower than the book does and let your brain figure out what the book is actually saying. But there are places where we're going to dip our toes into PG-13 territory, so I want you to have that warning in advance. Not because we want to go there, but because that's where the book goes, and we are not going to skip portions of Scripture just because they make us uncomfortable. All right, last time I'm going to say that, you have been forewarned. Talk to us if we need to do something to protect the kiddos. All right, Judges. Where does Judges fall in history? With that, we're really going to take a review, and what I want to do is I want to take about 6 minutes to cover about 6 books of the Bible, to bring us up to speed to where Judges is, because Judges is the 7th book in the Bible. You have your Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the first 5 books. That's where the term Pentateuch comes from, 5. And then we have the book of Joshua. We studied the book of Joshua together last year, so that should be fresh on our minds as we launch into Judges. And then Judges is our 7th book of the Old Testament. And what we've seen so far is, in Genesis, we had the creation of the world. I know it's tiny. We can take a picture. We can blow it up. Maybe it'll end up. But there are a lot of things to go on this timeline, so it's tiny. I can read it. If you can't, sorry. In Genesis, we had the creation of the world. We see that right at the beginning. And from creation, we see the generations through Noah, right? And through that period of time, the world just declines and declines. Sin enters the world immediately after creation. Things get worse and worse and worse until Noah comes on the scene. And that's when God says, you know what? That's it. I've had enough. I'm destroying everybody. And he destroys the entire world except for Noah and a representation of all the animals that are on the planet at that time, repopulates the earth from Noah's family. From Noah, we then see what we call the patriarchs, the fathers of the Jewish nation, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. These 4 lay the foundation for what will become the nation of Israel. Abraham being the first, who is justified by his faith in God, ends up being the father of Judaism. And then Isaac, his son, Jacob, and then Joseph is the one who saves the nation by being sold into slavery, rising through the ranks in Egypt, and becoming second only to the Pharaoh himself in Egypt. And through that, the nation of Israel goes down to, through his father Jacob and his 12 brothers, they all go down to Egypt, where they're going to spend the next 400 years. And that's what happens in the book of Genesis. In Exodus, when it picks up, we pick up from the end of Joseph's story, and we see that Israel has spent 400 years developing into a nation from this one family of 4 patriarchs. Over 400 years becomes a nation of Israel who is serving in slavery, because the book of Exodus starts with the idea that the Pharaoh forgot who Joseph was. So he starts mistreating the people. And it's in the book of Exodus that we see the Exodus, right? That's where the name of the book comes from. Through the man Moses, we see God take the people of Israel and redeem them back, saves them, brings them out of Egypt, saves them from slavery, and starts heading them towards a land that he has called their promised land. And at that, we see the story of Moses leading the people through Exodus, Numbers, and the book of Deuteronomy. In those three books, we see the story of Moses as he leads them towards the promised land, as they fail their first entrance into the promised land because they have a lack of faith. As we see them have to wander the desert for 40 years until an entire generation dies off. We see the story of Moses in Exodus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. We also see that God gave them the law, the things that were supposed to govern them both spiritually in their relationship with God and civically as part of their nation, the laws that were going to govern both the people, the Jewish people, and the nation of Israel. We see these laws given in Exodus. That's where we see the Ten Commandments in the first explanation of the law. Leviticus, where he gets into all the gritty details of the law. And then Deuteronomy, which that book, Deuteronomy, literally means second law. Deutero the second, namas, the law. And the idea that it retells the story of Moses and re-gives the law in one summary passage. All right? So that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And then we launch into the book of Joshua. And again, we just went through this a year ago, so it's fresh on many of our minds. If you want a review of the book of Joshua as a whole, if you want the long version, just go back and watch last year's sermon series through the book of Joshua. If you want the short version, I always recommend the Bible Project. They've got short 15-minute summaries of the entirety, every book of the Bible, and they are top-notch summaries that give you an idea of the book that you're reading. But we see the story of Joshua as he takes over for Moses after he dies. And as he steps into leadership, they are for the first time entering the land. We see him take them over the Jordan River, and they start conquering the land one nation at a time, Jericho being the first, and all the way through the end of Joshua's life. The book of Joshua, surprise, surprise, is about Joshua. And as Israel takes back the land, it specifically details as they start at Jericho, and they spread out throughout the land until ultimately we reach the end of the book and Joshua dies. And in his parting address to the people, he gives them a cry, a call to arms, a call to action, which is where we left this book off, where he called to the people and said, look, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. What he says, as for me and the generations that follow me, we have decided that God is going to be our leader. It was Moses following God. It was Joshua following God. Joshua says to the people, we are going to choose to follow God. He said, but choose you this day who you will follow. And he gives Israel this choice. Who are you going to follow? And that's where we left off the book of Joshua. Which means today as we start the book of Judges, that is the question that should be lingering on our mind. That is the last thing we heard in the life of the nation of Israel, is Joshua's call to choose you this day who you will follow, but for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Which is why it's significant that as we start the book of Judges, the first thing we see is this. And after the death of Joshua, which is where we just ended, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? Remember, at this point in history, what we have seen is Moses followed God. Joshua followed God. And as Joshua went into battle, we saw through the entire book, if he followed God, if he let God go first, if God was the one who was going to battle on their behalf, they couldn't lose. He has called them to do the same as a people just before his death, and the first thing they ask after he died is, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites? This should have been the most obvious question in Israel's history. They just spent a generation letting God go before them, conquering the land. At the end of Joshua, there is even a promise from God to Joshua where he says to Joshua, Joshua, you have done well. I'll take care of the rest of this. I will be the one to go and fight for you. I will be the one who conquers the rest of the land. Yet when Israel sees the death of Joshua, when their leader for the second time has died and left them leaderless, they don't know who to turn to. They're lost. They can't figure it out. So they go looking. Who's going to be our leader? And we are going to see this question in various forms through the entire book be the very question that ends them in trouble. Because while they're about to get it right, as we progress through this book, they get it more and more wrong with every iteration of this question. Every time they come back and ask the question, who is our leader going to be? It gets worse and worse and worse. And as they get farther and farther from God's choice and start pursuing their own desires, we see things go worse and worse for the nation. We're actually going to see more of that next week. Chapter 1 is more a transitional chapter between Joshua and the rest of the book of Judges. Next week, we're going to see a cycle put into place that is going to dictate the rest of the book. But for now, we're just picking up with the end of Joshua and transitioning into the book of Judges, and this is how he does it. It says, the Lord answered this question for them. He says, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand. And Judah said to Simeon his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you. So Simeon went up with him. Now, back to our history, because this sounds like two guys having a conversation with each other. Because it refers to them both as singular. Judah, the man, Simeon, his brother. That is very likely not the case, because Judah and Simeon would have been brothers of Joseph, which we just saw. Joseph was taken into slavery and back at the end of the patriarchs, back at the end of Genesis. They were then in slavery, or they were in Egypt for 400 years. Then they wandered the desert for 40 more years. And then they went through the entire lifetime of Joshua conquering the land of Israel for another 50-ish years. Judah and Simeon are not still alive. They are not 500 years old in the nation of Israel. What this is referring to is the tribes that have been descendants of Judah and Simeon. See, all the tribes of Israel end up named after the brothers of Joseph, except for the two. Joseph does not have a tribe named after him. The two, Ephraim and Manasseh, are named after Joseph's sons. So his brothers and his two sons. So Judah, the descendants of Judah, and the descendants of Simeon are the ones that we are talking about here. And the Lord answers, it's Judah. That's the tribe that is going to lead the nation. They are the ones who are going to go up first. This becomes significant later because Judah ends up being the one that God promises that Israel's ultimate leader, the one who is going to be their king, the one who's going to lead them in eternity, is going to come from the tribe of Judah. And what we ultimately see is that Jesus is a descendant of Judah. So while none of that has been established at that point, that comes through the prophets later on, God is already laying foundation here in the first chapter of Judges that there is coming a day where Judah will go up, Judah will conquer the land, and Judah will make everything on this planet right, and that is through the person of Jesus. But immediately, Judah gets it wrong. Right? This is a pattern that shows up all through the Old Testament, but we're going to see it a lot in the book of Judges. God gives a command, and the people of Israel almost get it right. They almost get it right. God says, Judah's the one. Judah's going to lead you into battle. Judah's the one that I have chosen, and I will give the land into Judah's hand. And Judah goes, okay. Simeon, you want to come too? Like, immediately turns to someone else. We see this in the life of Moses, right? Moses says, I can't speak. God, I know you're the one that you want me to go. You want me to do the thing. I'm not going to do it. I can't speak. I'm going to take Aaron with me. We see it through the rest of the book. We're going to see constantly as we get to judges like Deborah and Barak. God says, this is how I want it done. And they almost get it right. They get it like 75% right. Because Judah's still going to go, right? But he's too scared to go alone. He doesn't have enough faith to go on his own. So the nation invites Simeon to come with him. And he says, and when we do that, we'll get you back, Simeon. We'll have your back when you go to battle. And Judah goes up, and the Lord gives the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hand. And they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. And they found Adoni-Bezek and fought against him and defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. So here's the cool thing. Even though they get it 75% right, not 100% right, God still gives them the victory. But notice who is missing in this statement. No Simeon. Simeon went. Judah asked him to go. Simeon went. Makes sense. Judah was supposed to lead the entire nation into battle. But Judah is the only one mentioned when it comes to who the Lord chose to reward for his faithfulness. Simeon is nowhere to be found. We see this oftentimes as we work through the books, that when they get it 75% right, not 100% right, God will still show up. God does still show up because God is going to do what God is going to do. We cannot thwart the plans of God. Even with our sin, even when we mess it up, we cannot stop God's will. But like Moses says, I'm not going to go to Egypt unless I get to take Aaron with me. The very next chapter, we see Moses in front of Pharaoh. And you know how many times Aaron speaks in the courtroom of Pharaoh? How many times we see him talk at any point before Pharaoh? How many times does he address the Pharaoh? Zero. Not once. God says, okay, you can take Aaron. You'll let Aaron be your voice piece. Aaron will do all the talking. And then Aaron does no talking at all, because that's not who God sent. That was not God's plan. God sent Moses. And in this case, we see Judah. God sent Judah. Judah said, well, Simeon, you're going to come too. You're going to help me out. You're going to help me conquer these people. And God says, and Judah went up. And the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into Judah's hand, because Judah is the one God sent. But they win. They defeat the 10,000 of them at Bezek. And they find Adoni-Bezek. I just wanted to point out the Adoni part there. Adoni means Lord. So it can reference a king or a lord of the people. It is also why we use the term for God. We refer to God as Adoni because he is our Lord. He is our king. If you had heard that word before and wondered why it was being applied to a person, that's why. All right, Adoni-Bezek fled, but they pursued him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. And Adoni-Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. And they brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. All right? I was going to make a joke that this verse was in here just to give parents a small taste of what's coming, so you know I'm not joking around. But this is actually in here for a very significant reason. Because God gave very specific instructions to the Israelites. And we're about to see that they devoted the people of Canaan to destruction. And we talked about this back when we were looking at the book of Joshua. This idea that God called Israel to destroy the people of Canaan. And that they were devoted to destruction, and that there were three options left to the people of Canaan. The first, they could recognize Israel's God, God of the universe, the God, as their own God, and submit to him, and choose to become proselyte Jews, join the nation of Israel. That was always an option open to them. The second option that was given to the Canaanites, they could leave. If they chose to leave the land and give it to Israel the way that God had intended, God gave them the land, if they had recognized his authority, even if they didn't want to become a part of the nation, they had the option to leave. And if and only if they chose option three, was destruction actually the end point, where they said, No, we do not recognize God's authority. We do not recognize Israel's claim on the land. This is our land, and we are going to choose to stand in defiance of Israel and Israel's God. Then and only then did the third option come into play, which was wipe them out. No one left. And that phrase, devoted to destruction, meant to give them those three options, but they, one way or another, the land was to be given to Israel. And the reason for that was because of the moral failure of the land of Canaan. It was because Canaan, as a land, was known universally as a wicked, terrible place. And God said right off the bat, these people worship idols, they sacrifice children, they are a wicked people. I will not have you live amongst them. I will not let you live and intermarry with them in such a way that their practices will start to corrupt your worship of me. I need you to wipe them out. Or they can choose to start worshiping God. And what God is starting to do here through the introduction to this book is to point out where this went wrong. See, Adonai Bezek was a king who was known for being ruthlessly cruel. See, they cut off his thumbs and his big toes, and that sounds painful, but he almost brags about it. Even after being captured, he goes, I used to have 70 different kings with their thumbs and their big toes cut off, and he used to keep them almost as pets in their in his throne room. And they would pick up scraps under the table. And he treated these defeated kings as less than human. And God puts us there so we can see who this is, who this king is that we're talking about. But even this king understands. He's getting what he deserves. He declares it of himself. He says, as I have done, so God has repaid me. I am getting exactly what I deserve. I am being hoisted on my own petard. It is my doing to myself. So they bring him to Jerusalem, and that's where he dies. Now, at this point, Israel does not control Jerusalem. We see that here in this next verse. It says, and the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. They wouldn't have done that to their own city. This is where they are conquering and taking Jerusalem for the first time. It says, and afterwards, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who lived in the hill country, in the Negev, and in the lowland. And Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now, the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba, and they defeated Sheshai and Iman and Talmai. We are going to see a lot of names today, and for the most part, they're not that important. Not that they're not important, not that historians haven't studied them, not that they do not have significance as you start to study the nitty-gritty. They're just not impacting the overall story at this point, as most of us don't actually understand where these places are. But what is important is the fact that Judah is leading them into battle. And as they go, they start to conquer the land, just as God promised them they would. And as they defeat the Canaanites, they start taking this land that belongs to them. We see certain things start to creep into their thinking. They start to become comfortable. We see it start already in the next few verses. From there, they went against the inhabitants of Debir, and the name of Debir was formerly Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, he who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will give him Aisha, my daughter, for a wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. And he gave him Aisha, the daughter, for a while. Now, if you're like me, your brain is already spinning, trying to see what we just saw. Wait, what's the math on this? Cousin is the answer to the question. It is Othniel is the son of Caleb's younger brother. That would make him Caleb's nephew. So Caleb's daughter is his cousin. Which, in Israelite culture and back in the Levitical code, is not actually illegal. It's not against Levitical code. But it is just about as close as you can get to stepping over the line as possible. As we look at the Levitical code, it makes it very clear. You cannot marry a parent. You cannot marry an in-law. you cannot marry an aunt or an uncle. The rules on familial marrying was very specific. So they did not break the Levitical code. They just tiptoed as close as humanly possible to the code without breaking the law. This is chapter 1. By the time we get to chapters 18, 19, 20, we're kicking over the law and we're going like way over there. But right now in chapter 1, they're already 75% obedient, walking as close to the line as they possibly can. This is going to matter. But Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, is the one who goes to battle for Judah and wins the day. So he gets Aisha as his wife. And when she came to him, she urged him to ask her father for a field. And she dismounted from her donkey, and Caleb said to her, "What do you want?" And she said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you have set me in the land of Negev, give me also springs of water." And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. The piece that's significant here is the fact that she knows, Aisha knows, to ask for a blessing from Caleb. Why Caleb? Why does Caleb have the authority to give her a blessing that the Lord will honor? Because Caleb would have been the only other person other than Joshua who actually followed Moses. See, when Moses sent out the spies to the land, he sent out 12 spies. 10 came back and said, "Don't go into the land. They're giants. We're going to lose. We will never be able to conquer this land." Two of them, Joshua and Caleb, are the ones who came back and said, "Yeah, they're giants. Yes, this is going to be a hard battle. Yes, if we do it on our own, we're going to lose. But we're not our own. We've got God. We've got the Lord. We should go." Because of that, the people chose to follow the 10 spies instead of the 2. God curses them to wander the land for 40 years. But he gives this promise. Everyone else who is over the age of 21 at the time is going to die before we enter the land of Canaan, except for Joshua and Caleb. So they're the last two left who would have followed Moses out of Egypt who are still alive. Joshua has now died. Caleb is the last one left. So she says to her father, "All right, give me a blessing. Bless me and give me this land." And he does it. He gives her the upper springs and the lower springs. And the descendants of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up with the people of Judah from the city of Palms into the wilderness of Judah, which lies in the Negev near Arad. And the people went and settled. And they went and settled with the people. The descendants of the Kenite. Very likely what the author of Judges is referring to here is the nation of Judah. The tribe of Judah, the descendants of Othniel and Aisha, because if you look back here, it says that Othniel is the son of Kenaz, same root word, likely Kenaz is a descendant of the Kenite who was Moses' father-in-law, so Jethro. And now his descendants in the nation of Judah, the tribe of Judah, they are going to go up into this land that Caleb gave to his daughter and Othniel and settle that land, taking the nation of Judah up with them. And Judah went up with Simeon, his brother, and they defeated the Canaanites, who inhabited Zephath and devoted it to destruction. There's that phrase that we talked about. And the name of the city was called Hormah. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. So now it's just listing the places that Judah is able to conquer. We talk about the fact that it's devoted destruction. We already covered what that means. I just pointed this out, that Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, because this would have been the first time that Israel had full control over Gaza, a name that's still coming up for us to this day. This would have been somewhere between 1300 and 1400 BC or BCE, whichever nomenclature you prefer, but this would have been 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. We already have a record of the first time that Israel conquers Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon and Ekron. This is not a new phenomenon. This has been going on for a long, long time. And it says, "And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. And Hebron was given to Caleb, as Moses had said, and he drove out from there, from it, the three sons of Anak. The only thing that's confusing here is, if the Lord is with Judah, why couldn't he not drive out the inhabitants of the plain? We can explain this from a human point of view. The inhabitants of the plain have chariots of iron. Those chariots don't work all that well in the hills, but on the plains gives them a huge advantage. This would have been like having the most advanced warfighters of the time. Chariots of iron were the newest technology. They were incredibly effective at warfare as long as you were on flat surfaces. As soon as you get in the hills, they don't work. So it makes sense mentally and logically why that would be a problem. The thing that people struggle with here is, if the Lord was with Judah, that shouldn't matter at all. And there are people who speculate that the reason is because Judah didn't have enough faith. And contextually, that works. Contextually, that makes sense. As we look through the book of Judges, as we look through the previous books, Joshua and the Pentateuch, it makes sense that it would be a lack of faith on Judah's part. But the truly transparent answer is, we don't know. The book of Judges does not actually give us the answer to why, if the Lord was with Judah, they were not able to do this. Our best guess is there was something done on Judah's part that created a lack of faith. Possibly the choice to take Simeon with him, it just doesn't make that clear. But Hebron is given to Caleb as Moses had said it would. God's fulfilling prophecy again, and he drove them out, the three sons of Anak. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites, who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. And we are about to see something that, when God repeats something in Scripture, it's something we should take note of. We're about to see something that we should really, really take note of. But it's all going to start right here on this pivot. Because up till now, they've been obedient. Up till now, at least 75% obedient, and at least just this side of the line, they have been obedient. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites, who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. As the author is writing this, it's still the case. We've got to remember, what is the reason God said to devote the people to destruction? The reason they were to be devoted to destruction was because God did not want the people of Israel living with people who were not of Israel. He did not want them living side by side. He did not want them living right with and intermarrying with idolaters, people who sacrificed children to the gods, people who were morally corrupt on such an extreme level that they were known throughout the nation as a wicked people. God did not want these two peoples to mingle. He did not want them living next to each other. And that's exactly what the tribe of Benjamin chooses to do. They don't drive out the Jebusites. They don't devote them to destruction the way that God instructed them to do. And as a result, they have lived with the people of Benjamin to this day. And the house of Joseph also went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with them. And the house of Joseph scouted out Bethel. Now the name of the city was formerly Luz. And the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Please show us the way into the city, and we will deal kindly with you." This would have had all kinds of memories for the nation of Israel. If you remember all the way back to the beginning of the book of Joshua, there was a woman named Rahab, and she took in spies, and she ends up protecting the spies, and they give her a promise. When it comes time to defeat Jericho, you will live. We end up seeing the same thing here. They go to this man who's coming out of the city saying, "Here, show us how to get into the city. Show us how to conquer your city, and we will deal kindly with you." And he showed them the way into the city, and they struck the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man and all his family go. And the man went into the land of the Hittites and built a city and called its name Luz, and that is the name to this day. Big difference between this man and Rahab. Rahab hid the spies, chose to follow God, chose to support the nation of Israel, and she was allowed to become a part of the nation of Israel. She took option number one in our devoted to destruction checklist. She took option one, said, yes, I am going to follow your God. I'm going to honor your God over my gods. I'm going to reject my family. I'm going to reject my history. I'm going to reject that, and I'm going to follow your God. And she came into the nation. This is different. They asked him for help. He gave their help, and then they let him leave the nation. This is an act of disobedience, because he goes and he creates his own city. He names it Luz, which is what the city that they just destroyed was called, and he ends up just replanting all the problems from the previous city in this new city. And as the writer writes the book of Judges, he says, and that is still its name today. It still exists, not as a city of Israel, but as a city of Canaanites within the nation of Israel. Manasseh, and here's where we're going to see our pattern crop up, did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Iblim and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. For the Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. Devote to destruction, so they will not live amongst you. The Canaanites persisted in dwelling in that land. So when Israel grew strong, they did not put the Canaanites to forced labor, or they put the Canaanites into forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. And Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. So the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. They got strong, they got complacent. They're like, we don't actually have to obey God anymore. We'll just make them slaves instead. That's close enough, right? Check, 75%. Not 100. So the Canaanites live in Gezer among them. And Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahal. So the Canaanites lived among them, but became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko, or the inhabitants of Sidon, or Halab, or Eshzib, I'm guessing at half of these, by the way, or of Helba, or of Aphek, or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, in the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh, or the inhabitants of Beth Anath. So they lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. If you're not getting this, they did not drive them out. They lived among them. This is disobedience to its core. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anath became subject to forced labor for them. The Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come into the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres, and Echelon, and Shalmbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor, and the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akarabim, from Sela, and upward. As I said, Judges chapter 1 is a transition from Joshua to everything that's coming in the rest of the book. And the main point is this: God gave clear instructions to Joshua and the people of Israel. Israel chose to disobey. Israel chose 75% obedience. And 75% obedience is 100% disobedience. And everything that comes next is a result of Israel's disobedience. I've said it. I'll say it again, Judges is not going in happy places. It starts bad, it gets worse. So what? What does that matter to us? What does this mean to us some 3,000 to 4,000 years later? Well, the person we should want leading us is God. This is a lesson Israel should have had 100% figured out 3,000 years ago. They had watched him lead well. They had watched him lead Moses. They had watched him lead Joshua. They should have known who should have led them to battle. And it wasn't a person. It was their God. Second, God knows best, and we need to trust him. God knows what the plan is. God knows what we need to do to succeed. God knows everything, And we need to trust him such that when he gives us a command, we must obey 100%. One of my favorite cliche phrases around obedience is 99% obedience is 100% disobedience. When God gives us a command, we must obey 100%. If God is calling you to do something in your life, to take a stand, to take a step in faith, to move forward, even if it makes no sense to you, we need to know that God knows best and obey 100%. Anything less is disobedience. And that's not because God is a ruthless dictator who's going to punish us if we don't. It's simply because it's what's best for us. Israel disobeys, and we will see all the consequences of that that are brought upon them by their own hand. But when they choose to obey, and we'll see some of that too in this book, and God shows up and they do what God has called them to do, the person who benefits from that is them. So today, when God gives you a command, if God is calling you to take a step, whatever that is, just say yes. Father, I thank you for the example of Israel. Thank you for the opportunity to learn from the mistakes of another. Because we see through them that obeying you benefits us. You deserve our obedience no matter what. But it's foolishness to ignore it when the only person we're going to hurt is ourselves. So, Father, as we move through this book, as we work forward, looking at your nation, I pray that you would make it clear for us the steps you're calling us to take. And, Father, create an excited response in us to do what you are calling us to do 100%. In your Son's name, amen.